SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, and SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D video journal, is pleased to present in association with the Sub-Saharan African Neurosurgeons, another in the series of Sub-Saharan Africa International Neurosurgery Grand Rounds, held on the first Sunday of each month. The general title of the Grand Rounds is Global Solutions to Clinical Challenges in Neurosurgery. The moderators are Estrada Bernard and James Ausman. The title of this presentation is Management of Intracerebral Hemorrhage, Past, Present, and Future, a lecture and discussion, given by Cargo Aline Jr., who is the former professor and chairman, residency program director in the Department of Neurosurgery at the Medical College of Georgia, was trained at the Yale University School of Medicine, did his neurosurgery training at Emory University in Atlanta, and was also on the staff of the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. He's now associated with Piedmont Physicians Neurosurgery in Atlanta.
Yeah, sure. So Dr. Aline was professor and chairman of the Department of the Medical College of Georgia. He's currently in private practice. I think he was chairman there for about 10 years, and he can correct me.
That's
he
correct.
did his neurosurgery residency training at Emory University and was on the faculty at the University of Rochester in New York before he went on to the faculty at the Medical College of Georgia, where he was chairman. He has expertise in cerebrovascular disease, trained in both endovascular and open vascular treatment. And we're glad that he's agreed to be our guest speaker, and he's going to be talking about management of intracerebral hemorrhage. Dr. Aline, thank you again. Welcome. Well,
thanks again, Dr. Bernard and Dr. Ausman, for inviting me. Can you guys see my slides?
No, not yet.
Okay, hang on a second. I thought it was up, but did the previous speaker stop sharing?
Yes.
Okay. I think I may have done it while his was still up, so let me... Let me start.
It looks like it's coming on. Yes, there we go. Yes, we can see it now.
Terrific. All right, well, thanks again. So today I'm just going to give a brief overview of the management of spontaneous intracranial hemorrhage. And first I'll say I have no disclosures, although I will mention a couple of medications and two devices, company-related devices, to which I have no affiliation or financial contact with. So I'll start with a brief introduction and then go on to management of hypertensive intracranial hemorrhage, and very briefly finish up with two other causes of spontaneous ICH, AVMs, and cavernous malformations. So again, most of you already know these stats, but in the US, there's one in every six deaths from cardiovascular disease is due to stroke. That's based on the AHA data from 2018. One person has a stroke every 40 seconds, and every 4 minutes, someone dies of a stroke. Another way of looking at it is almost 800,000 persons per year in the U.S. will have a stroke. As you know, most strokes are actually of the ischemic variety, 85% of all.
Cargo, let me interrupt you for a minute. We're seeing a screen that's a flow chart. Is that what we should be seeing right now?
No, you should be seeing, hang on a second. You should be seeing my slides advancing.
No, we're not seeing that.
Okay, hang on a second. I think I know what the problem might be.
We are seeing his slide.
How about now?
Yeah, now we're seeing, yes. If you could start from the beginning. Yes, now we see it. Thank you.
Great, terrific. So as I mentioned, no disclosures. And I'll just start with a brief introduction, hypertensive and then AVMs and CAB mouths. I think I mentioned that. I mentioned the stats, so I won't go over that again. So yeah, 85% of strokes are ischemic when there's a blockage of a small arteriole in the brain, and 15% is hemorrhagic when there's actually a rupture of a small vessel. And there are two types of hemorrhagic strokes, as you know, subarachnoid, intracerebral. So I'll confine my discussion to the intracerebral hemorrhages. So again, these are twice as common as subarachnoid hemorrhage and has a 40% risk of death. I'll briefly go over some of the recent 2022 guidelines for the management of patients with spontaneous ICH. So this is a pretty dense document. I'm obviously not going to go through all the detail and trivia in there, but just as a way of getting a handle on it, they basically reviewed the literature and came up with classes or strengths of recommendation for each of their recommendations, and also the level or quality of evidence. So for instance, in terms of the strength of recommendation, it can range from a class one, where the benefit clearly outweighs the risk of treatment, all the way down to a class three. A moderate class three shows that there's no benefit of that intervention, or a strong class three where there's actually harm. So the risk is very much greater than any benefit that might be gleaned. And then on the level of evidence side, a level A is high quality evidence from at least one randomized controlled trial, all the way down to a level C, which is basically some limited data, meta-analyses, or even just consensus of expert opinion. So in terms of blood pressure management, when a patient comes in, they make mention that the titration down to a relatively normal pressure should be smooth and controlled. So avoid any sudden swings in blood pressure from too high to too low. Initiating treatment within 2 hours of the ICH onset and reaching a target within 1 hour is ideal. And when someone presents with hypertension defined as anything over 150 to 220, getting it down to a range of about 130 to 150 is ideal. So aiming for about 140. If it's lowered any lower than 130, that can be potentially harmful. A lot of these patients already have chronic hypertension, and so if you overcorrect them, you could be setting up for an ischemic problem when they've already presented with a hemorrhagic one. So be careful of lowering the blood pressure too rapidly or too drastically. I don't know about Africa, but a lot of patients in the U.S. come in with some type of anticoagulation because, as I mentioned before, heart disease is a concomitant risk factor. So this is a useful chart when someone presents with an ICH and they're on anticoagulation. There are four main categories. If they come in with a vitamin K antagonist like Coumadin, depending on the INR level, you can give PCC, which is a prothrombin complex contrate, in two separate levels. So either 10 to 20 units per kilogram or 25 to 50 units per kilogram. If they present having been on dabigatran, which is Pradaxa, or with a factor 8 inhibitor, one of the newer direct oral anticoagulation, then you can give them activated charcoal if they present within 2 hours of taking that medication. But most patients present, you know, several hours after taking the meds. So if that's the case, then you can give one of the antagonists. The specific antagonist for the Pradaxa is idarucizumab, and the specific one for Eliquis or apixaban is adnexanet alpha. If they're not available, then you give PCCs to correct the effect of the anticoagulation. And then obviously, if they're in heparins, you would give protamine to counteract the effect of the of heparin. So what about surgery for these patients? Well, You know, historically, we perform surgery for large ICH patients if they're severe neurological deficit or deteriorating. And, you know, surprisingly, there's not a lot of data to suggest that it actually convincingly improves functional outcome or mortality. So the level of data is weak, as you can see on the left there, 2B. But the recommendation is for most patients with spontaneous ICH of moderate or greater severity, usefulness of craniotomy to improve functional outcomes or mortality is uncertain. And then for patients who are deteriorating, craniotomy for evacuation might be considered a life-saving measure. So that's generally the time when we present patients with this option, is when they're acutely deteriorating and there's a chance that we can actually save their life. Well, patients that present with posterior fossa hemorrhage are a subcategory, which is a little, the data is a little more clear. You can see the level of incidence is a, or the recommendation is a class one, which is pretty strong. So for patients with cerebellar hemorrhage who are deteriorating neurologically, have brainstem compression and or hydrocephalus from ventricular obstruction, or have an ICH volume greater than 15, then immediate surgical removal of the hemorrhage with or without EVD is recommended. And this has clearly been shown to be superior to medical management and will reduce mortality. So that's a clear recommendation. Now, so here's a patient of mine from a few months ago, a 68-year-old woman presented with severe hypertension and headache, had this massive cerebellar hemorrhage. There's really not a question or a discussion as to what should be done. The literature clearly supports taking her to surgery as we did emergently. You can see the coronal and sagittal images here showing severe compression of the local structures, including the brainstem. And she actually did quite well. So we did a suboccipital craniectomy. Some people might do a bilateral. We did unilateral because we can get from one side to the other. We're able to get a fairly good evacuation of the hematoma. So that's the, on the left is the immediate post-op on day one. And on the right is 4 weeks after surgery. And she made a remarkable recovery back to normal. Well, in the last several years, we've made a brave attempt to use minimally invasive surgeries to try to affect the outcome of ICH disease. And again, this is a recommendation from 2022, but they reviewed the largest randomized controlled trial, which is the MISTI-3 trial. There have been several of them, the STITCH 1, STITCH 2, and they were all somewhat disappointing, just showing very lukewarm benefit or no benefit at all. But in the largest trial, which was really a meta-analysis of trial comparing minimally invasive surgery with conventional craniotomy and standard medical care, they found that for patients with clots greater than 20 or 30 ml volume, a GCS score in the moderate range, then MIS evacuation with endoscopic or stereotactic aspiration can be useful to reduce mortality compared to medical management alone. They also found that it might be reasonable to select this over conventional craniotomy to improve functional outcomes, and that the effectiveness is still uncertain. So up until now, the data was still somewhat soft on the utility of using MIS until this year. So for the first time, this is the ENRICH trial, which was published this year in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I was run out of Grady Hospital, actually, at Emory, where I did some of my training. But what they did is looked at patients with a volume of 30 to 80 ml presenting within 24 hours of last known well. And they performed a small craniotomy and then used a minimal access port and image guidance. So they actually used the NICO device to evacuate intracranial hemorrhages. They also did some management that was common to both the treatment and the control group, aggressive resuscitation, blood pressure control, correction of any bleeding issues, and traditional surgical techniques like EVD or craniectomy for life-threatening situations. But what they found is that The minimally invasive ICH evacuation compared to medical management resulted in better functional outcome at 180 days in low bar ICHs. The 30-day mortality was cut in half, so from 18% in the control group down to 9.3%, and there was a low 3.3 risk of rebleeding after the MIS surgery. So again, you know, we've been sort of doing this half-heartedly for the last several years, but this is the first time that there's been definitive proof that it actually does result in a better outcome for the low bar hemorrhages. So the effect for the deeper ICHs was not there at this stage, but this is encouraging data. So I just want to show you quickly. This is at our shop. We have the Artemis device, which is a endoscopic suction device. Yeah.
Can you go back to that previous slide for a minute?
Yes.
Go back one slide. Yes, it says the 30-day mortality in the surgical group. You just go back to the slide. 30-day mortality in the surgical group was much higher than was in the control group, right? Was it? Did I get that right? 9.3%. 8%. There. Okay.
Compared to 18.
I misread that. So it's lower in the surgical group. Okay, I'm sorry.
Exactly. Yeah, so it's basically cut in half compared to the control group. And this is actually the first time that this has been shown. So I just want to go through one, just a technique of, and again, I'm not endorsing any particular device. There are several out there. This is one that we use called the Artemis Penumbra device. But I'll show a very quick video here to outline how it's done. So it's important to get an image guided a CAT scan before the procedure. The Artemis is a endoscopic suction device, and so the patient's taken to the operating room, intubated, placed in pins for the ease of using the image guidance. And the key is to use the long axis of the clot to plan the trajectory. And then if you extrapolate out, that basically gives you the entry point where the burble should be made. So once that's done with image guidance, the peel away sheet is peeled down to the level of the scalp. And then the endoscope through which the Artemis is placed is then advanced through the peel away sheath down to about somewhere between 2/3 to 3/4 of the length of axis of the clot. Device is turned on. It's a simple suction device with irrigation that can then evacuate the clot with great efficiency. And the endoscopic port enables you to see the margins of the clot removal, just to ensure that you've got complete removal or near complete removal. You can actually move that scope back and forth to view the anatomy as you're pulling out. So here's a patient of mine that I did probably a few months ago now, came in with this left-sided deep ICH. When we projected the entry point, it actually ended up being very close to the front of the forehead. And obviously, it's pretty hard to do a craniotomy there. So we actually did an eyebrow incision directly over the eyebrow, did a very small craniotomy, as you can see on that second image. And then advance the endoscope down to evacuate the clot. So that third CAT scan is post-op day one, and then the one on the right is actually the six-week follow-up. And he made a good recovery. The hope, the suggestion is that by getting the clot out sooner, you reduce the secondary injury that can occur after the hematoma breaks down, and also get the patients home faster. So the length of stay tends to be shorter for these patients compared to just medical management alone. So very quickly, moving on to AVMs, they occur in about 1% of the population. Patient can present with bleeding, obviously also seizures, headache, and stroke. As we all know, it's a direct connection of one or more arteries to one or more veins without an intervening capillary bed. And the three main components are the feeders, the nidus, and the venous outflow. So the treatment options here are varied. Obviously, there's surgery. There is numerous endovascular treatment or embolization, which is not generally used to cure an AVM, but can be used to make the surgery safer. There, I can remember maybe two AVMs in my entire career where we actually cured the AVM simply because it was very small and there was a single feeding artery, which we could shut down. But most commonly we use combined treatment, and there's several patients who have large whole hemispheric AVMs for which we know that the treatment, the risk of treatment is much higher than the natural history, so we just leave those alone. So this is a patient that comes in with a 56-year-old man with headache and dysphagia, and a CAT scan shows this bleed, which obviously could be hypertensive, but given the fact that he did not have a history of hypertension, was relatively young, we suspected an AVM. So the MRI and then eventually the angiogram show this, and I'll show the sequences here. This is a lateral view of a left internal carotid injection. So that's the ICA going up, and there's a ACA branch, early arterial, mid-arterial, showing the nidus. And then as the venous phase evolves, you can see several multiple ectatic vessels. I don't know if you can see my pointer, but this is the largest one. But there are also some venous aneurysms as well. And almost certainly he bled from one of these ectatic vessels, probably the larger one. There's another view, and then the late venous phase draining both into the vena lovae and trollard. And this is just the AP view again, showing both anterior and middle cerebral artery feeders and dominant draining veins into those sinuses that I mentioned. So in order to treat this, we started out by doing a two-stage embolization procedure where we used Onyx glue. You can see the glue embolizate there and here. So we did ACA feeders and then came back and did MCA feeders, which, you know, cut down on the flow to the AVM. But as I mentioned, this is not a cure. This just simply helps to make surgery a bit safer. And then this is the post-embo AP view. Again, seeing the nidus again, partial embolization. It's not quite as dense as the pre-embo image. And then we take the patient to surgery. So this is the post-embo MRI scan. We use image guidance to help localize the nidus as we're operating. And I'll just briefly show a schematic of the technique of how I resect these AVMs. So it's important to keep the head, the AVM uppermost when you're positioning. Again, using image guidance. And you want to do a wide skin incision. You want to encompass the entire nidus and any draining veins that you might encounter. Retract the scalp flap, do a generous craniotomy, and then you reflect the dura generally towards the main sinus, in this case, the sagittal sinus. Again, taking care to identify any draining veins that might be present. So for instance, if there's a draining vein that's attached to the dura, you don't want to rip that. It'll be a very quick case if that happens. So you can leave the dural attachment to that draining vein while reflecting the rest of the dura. And then the technique is simply circumscribing the AVM, going from superficial to deep, while identifying all the feeders, starting superficially and then going deeper, and then basically coagulating them. So you can either use a small AVM clip, a bipolar, and then sectioning. And then as you go deeper and deeper, the nidus should collapse. You should start to see a change in the color from arterial red to more purple, and then eventually venous. And then at the very end, you want to, and of course, preserving any en passant vessels that might appear to go to the nidus, but going past it. And at the very end, you identify the major draining vein, and that's the last thing that you take. So obviously, you don't want to take that prematurely because then you can end up with an exploding nidus, which is pretty hard to take care of. That's the general technique, and that's exactly what we did in this patient. I'll show you the intraoperative image here after the resection. And this is the post-op arteriogram, lateral and AP view showing complete resection. So one note is that, so we didn't actually address the venous varix. There's absolutely no reason to go plowing into that area if you remove the nidus, because the venous ectatic anatomical result is from the AVM. So the nidus, the high flow nidus is attempting to drain into the normal venous system and dilating. So if you just take care of that nidus, the venous system will take care of itself. And that happens to be an eloquent tissue. So you certainly don't want to go into that that area. And then lastly, very briefly, cavernous malformations, another source of spontaneous hemorrhage. That's Flojo on the right. She actually died of a cav mal in her sleep, probably from a hemorrhage or a seizure. But these are well-circumscribed lesions, closely packed cluster of blood vessels without intervening parenchyma, generally looking dark or purple, described as mulberry-like. There's usually evidence of hemosiderin staining, and they can range from a few millimeters to several centimeters with a rupture rate of about 1% per year. And that staining can be the source of seizure activity. But they can bleed, again, at a rate of 1% per year. This is a patient who presents with a slowly progressive hemiparesis, but came in with a relatively sudden headache. And this preoperative MRI scan, which shows this blood collection in the posterior fossa. Here's the actual view. You can see it's partly in the brainstem, partly in the cerebral peduncle, and partly in the fourth ventricle. So it's exophytic and with some acute blood. And this is the CAT scan, again, showing the acute blood. So this patient, with his history and presentation, obviously needs surgery. There's really no substantial evidence to suggest that any other treatment is as effective. There's some soft data on radiosurgery for CAV mals, but it's not the generally accepted way to go. So this patient we took to surgery. He's positioned with the head down. The head is towards the floor. The foot is towards the ceiling. So we're looking, so we've elevated the cerebral hemisphere. We're looking into the fourth ventricle. And here you can see the choroid plexus. Now there is the exophytic part of the cavernous malformation. I'm doing using image guided, using monitoring, SSEPs. Obviously in this critical area, you want to use all the ancillary techniques. So we're coagulating the exophytic portion of the cav mal. And then once we open it with the 11 blade, you can see the acute blood that extrudes out spontaneously. And then once the acute blood is cleared, you have a slightly better view of the actual lesion, which is sitting in the brainstem there at the floor of the fourth ventricle. The opening is widened. And the key here is to identify normal hemosiderin stained brain, or brainstem in this case, from the actual cavernous malformation. That's sometimes tricky to do, but with a little bit of patience and using a semi-sharp dissection tool here, Roten 1 or 2, you can actually tease the cav mal from the surrounding eloquent tissue to facilitate resection. Here we're using a small micro grabber and putting some tension on it. Here we're using threading of the forceps of the bipolar to help identify the plane. And right there, you can see that lighter area, which is actually the brainstem. And then this can be resected in a piecemeal fashion. At the very end, you know, we try to look for any small pockets of these little bubbles that can recur. But, you know, when you're in the brainstem, you've got to be a little bit more reticent to kind of go into the brainstem. You don't want to do that. You just want to try to stay into that in that plane that separates the normal brainstem from the lesion. And this is the post-op MRI scan. So I'll end with just one other piece of technology that we've been using for a few years now. At my shop, Piedmont Augusta, we just got comprehensive stroke certification status from the DNV. And we've been using the VizAI, which is an artificial intelligence app that basically reads the MRI scan even before the radiologists have a chance to do it. And it will alert you as to whether or not the patient has a large vessel occlusion in the case of ischemic stroke or an ICH. And we can scroll through the images. In the case of ICH, we can pull up the perfusion studies if that was done. And we can also communicate back and forth between practitioners to facilitate management. And this has helped with the communication as well as with the management decision as to whether or not to intervene on patients with these diseases. So I'll stop there and ask if there are any questions.
Outstanding job, Cargill. Just terrific job.
Thank you.
You want to stop sharing screen and Strada, we see who, I'm sure people have got thoughts or questions about this.
Yes. Thank you, Cargill. That was excellent. A very comprehensive review and exquisite intraoperative pictures. Much appreciated. Any questions or comments? Well, I'll start. Yeah. You know, I've had it when in my early part of my career, I had quite a bit of interest in intracerebral hemorrhages and tried doing evacuations with the Archimedean screw stereotactically, but didn't make much of a difference. I think the first surgical randomized clinical trial in all of surgery was by McKissick in 1961. He did a clinical trial on surgical evacuation of intracerebral hemorrhages and found that for lobar hemorrhages, the study was for lobar hemorrhages, that they improved their mortality. So the more recent results are just further confirmation, but also adding that you can improve the functional outcomes. But importantly, I think where we just can't make a difference is with those deep hemorrhages, the basal ganglia hemorrhages, and you know that is sort of like the spinal cord injury discussion we were having. But the neurologic status on presentation and the size and the location seem to be the primary prognostic indicators.
Personally, I think there's going to be a combination of surgical and medical management. We've got to be able to. Some of my early research at MCG was with curcumin, which is an ingredient in curry powder, and that actually does show an improvement in multiple types of stroke, ischemic and ICH and subarachnoid. So I think down the road we'll be able to probably do a procedure, but also give a medication that can help reduce that, those breakdown products of blood that then result in more edema and that kind of vicious cycle.
So, Professor, what's your approach to intraventricular hemorrhages? Are you aggressively irrigating? I mean, how do you manage those hematomas in which there is rupture into the ventricle?
So, good question. So, up until now, we've basically been just putting EVDs in, and as you know, they'll end up clotting off. The nurse will call you, oh, it's clotted again. So what I found to work is actually just injecting some TPA and just, small volume, turning it off for about 10 minutes and then opening it. And that actually will lyse much of the clot, certainly the one around the EVD catheter. And that with continuous drainage, that would work. I know there are several centers that have tried continuous drainage, but the evidence that using the MIS works with ICH, I think some people are now trying to use, for instance, the Artemis with IVHs, because it's just a stone's throw from going intraparenchymally to going into the ventricle and evacuating the clot with the same port. So that's what I've started doing. We've only had one case that had a reasonable outcome, but I think that's one way of evacuating a large volume of the clot right away to prevent, hydrocephalus or any impending herniation.
Strada, we got two questions, one from Sam and the other from Michael.
Okay, sure. Dr. Kawa, we'll go ahead. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to stick to the issue of the intraparenchymal hemorrhages. We have a series of over 200 cases that we started with ultrasound guided, and then we moved to together with the navigation system. And we're using just regular endoscopy procedures. We don't have the type of endoscopy that you exhibited, but we use the regular endoscopy. Now, my question is, when we're doing it, we don't aim at removing all the clot. because of the fear of rebleed. What is your experience with that? Two, at what time would you go into surgery? How many days after? And do you consider the volume and the Glasgow of the case? Because when we started with Glasgow of 3, 4, we don't. We had a lot of mortality, and now we don't go with that. But I must confess that in the last 2 cases, we had a Glasgow of 4, and they were nurses postpartum, and they did so well. So we still have that challenge as to whether to go with 4 or not.
Yeah.
And then, so if you could address that.
I think most people would agree with that exact management. We were very hesitant to go after someone who's, you know, GCS 3, 4, 5. And in fact, the study was done with a moderate group. So, you know, the exception, I think, would be if it's low bar, someone presents in a moderate grade, but then you actually see them actively deteriorate. So if they deteriorate to a GCS 4 or 3 before your eyes or in the CAT scanner, that would be my one exception when I would actually be relatively aggressive, especially if the patient's young, because I do agree you can actually salvage a fair amount of those. But I don't think the data is there yet to suggest that we can reverse someone who's, had a blown pupil or both blown pupils for a while. I mean, if there's underlying brainstem, Duray hemorrhages, there's really no reason to take someone like that to the operating room. But if they're young, if it's relatively recent, if it's a relatively acute deterioration, I think it does make sense. And in terms of the, what was your other question? I forget.
The other question had to do with the level of resection or aspiration, because we use the regular endoscope and we don't aim at cleaning the entire blood because of fear of free bleed, especially if you're not able to control the bleed.
Right, that's right. And I think that's probably the safest thing to do.
What we should notice is when you got a patient with high creatinine, they tend to rebleed a lot, and we don't want to remove everything, leave something small there as a tap on it. I don't know your experience.
Yeah, there's a philosophical difference between, you know, the early users and the late users. I think the literature shows that if you operate ultra early, you're more likely to get a rebleed. And that's common sense. So most people don't rush someone to the operating room if they're stable right away, but wait up to a day. I mean, for the case I showed, that was actually done 2 days after because he was stable. And it gave us time to get the image guided study. The study I cited, they did it 24 hours. So I think it makes sense, unless someone's deteriorating, not to rush them as a level one, you know, procedure, unless again they're actively deteriorating with a blown pupil and, you know, they're in the process of herniating.
Terrific. Thank you. Dr. Magoha, you have your hand raised.
Thank you. Dr. Kaba asked half of my question. The first thing is, yes, locally we might use the Lotter system here, largely the little Lotter system, which will allow us to suck, but thick, large clots, we won't be able to. I had two questions. I saw the brow incision and the beautiful frontal burr hole. We just use the standard burr hole, the frontal and occipital burr holes. Just a comment on that. What about large bleeds? We tend to get massive bleeds extending all the way, typical hypertensive bleeds.
Yep.
And we're very scared with dealing with that. And locally, we have one other issue, which is not really in the textbook, but it's quite strange. I want your comment. So if we have neurosurgeons who are in the peripheral facilities and they attempt a craniotomy and it doesn't work, and then they're referred to us in the referral facility, so we might attempt a coaxial approach where we'll go through the original craniotomy and then insert the endoscope and try and use some hemostatic agents, mostly in finding the bleeder and not just removing the clot. But that's just for selected patients every now and then. As you said, the ones you want to give a chance, young, they seem to respond but have a rebleed. What would you comment on both of those? And also, more importantly, though we do have neuronavigation, it's not widely available. And I know some of my residents are listening. So how would you tell them how to go about that? Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, I think there are many ways to skin a cat. The only reason why the suggestion is made to kind of use a forehead incision or an eyebrow is if the clot is longer in a craniocaudal, you know, if it's oval shaped, just from a logistical standpoint, you're more likely to see the edges of the clot as you go in and out along the long axis. But there's nothing wrong with doing a typical Coker burr hole and getting it from that perspective, especially if it's, you know, you're going through the right frontal lobe, which is relatively non-eloquent. So again, many ways to skin a cat. So I don't think that's, you know, it's not critical, but I think as you worry about getting as much of the clot out as safely as possible, you're able to see the edges a little better than going in from the short axis and not being able to get that endoscope to swing all the way anteriorly and posteriorly. So you're more likely to leave a larger residual just from a geometric standpoint if you go through the long axis as opposed to going through a short axis of the lesion.
There's a question in the chat from Dr. Consory regarding the pathology in Africa with respect to amyloid angiopathy, which used to be called congophilic angiopathy.
That's right.
So the participants who are in Africa, any sense of how often the hemorrhages are attributable to amyloid angiopathy? Or have there been pathology studies looking at that question?
Doesn't look like it. Okay. Alvin, what do you do for intracerebral hemorrhage, intracerebral hematoma in your country? Alvin, Doe?
Hello?
Alvin.
Go ahead,
so,
Alvin.
Thank you. So it is interesting, and I was following closely, but surprisingly, in Liberia, there have been these issues of which team manages spontaneous intracerebral bleed. So here, internal medicine, since we do not have a neurology, we only have internal medicine, so most often, internal medicine is in charge. It is when they only call neurosurgery for whether there is any need for surgical intervention. So ideally, most often, we usually see them late. We are not the first on. But most often, there are some that we usually do decompressive craniectomy. And after the resumption of the brain swelling, and then we plan for 6 months after to place back the bone flap. And that's how we usually use an extended EVD. But most often these patients are usually seen by us late.
Yeah, excellent point. Hello, Dr.
So I had another question, Jim. So Dr. Doe, how do you store those craniectomy flaps?
Oh, good. So, you know, Liberia, we do not have a bone bank. So I usually place it within the abdominal wall. And that's what we usually do here.
How I used to do that early in my career. I must tell you, I had quite a bit of issues with infection. So we resorted to storing all of them in the freezer. But has infection been an issue for you?
The severals we have done, no. Luckily.
How about bone resorption? One of my colleagues used to do it at another institution, and he abandoned it too, just because he said he realized that a large percentage of those that he replaced would just auto-resorb. They would just kind of shrink, and he couldn't figure it out. So, I mean, I'm not sure why that would happen, but have you seen that happening in the ones that you place in the belly?
No, we have not had condition of that kind, but I guess Because most often I usually do that with the general surgeon, because he is often there and we try our best to reduce all risk of infection in the process. Thank you.
Yeah, then Dr. Aileen, so some people, many may not have access to endoscopy. Can you comment on whether there have been any comparisons of open versus endoscopic evacuation of intracerebral hemorrhages?
Yeah, so the 2022 AHA data, they did compare MIS with open craniotomy, and there's soft data that the MIS might show an improvement. You know, I think that anything that you can do to reduce traversing normal brain is helpful, but it doesn't have to be an endoscope. For instance, we have you can use any one of the retractors that you can, the minimally invasive retractors that you can place, you know, transsulcal, and you can actually do an open surgery through a minimally a tubular port, and still I think reduce the risk of the damage that you can suffer, you know, plowing through normal brain. You know, if I remember in the old days, we would put in the flat retractors and that would just tear through normal brain tissue to get at the clot. And now, it's pretty clear that if you use a tubular retractor and then you just expand, you're just kind of compressing the normal brain, which then re-expands once you take that out. So I think that although an endoscope might be, ideal, it's not necessarily the only way to do a minimally invasive evacuation of an ICH.
Yeah, I think that's
one other point I was going to make is the big advantage, of course, is of putting the bone flap in the belly is that you never lose it. I did a case just last week, and we were replacing a bone flap several months after evacuation for a large stroke, and we could not find a flap. And we're like, where is this flap? We know it's in there. And luckily, we realized that the patient came in as a Jane Doe when she initially presented, and then later on they got a real name. So in a chart, her real name is in there, but the bone flap is listed as a Jane Doe. Mm. So thankfully, I kept a little sticky of, I did this starting out when I was an intern, keeping a little sticky of every patient that I ever, perform a procedure on. So I have I'm old-fashioned, a little ledger with all these stickies on the patient's name and medical record number. So I looked back and I found, it was Jane Doe. So we averted a disaster. So,
Jay, and how do you treat this problem?
Yeah, I don't know if I can make a comment.
Jay, you have...
Go ahead, Dr. Kaba.
Yeah, so in our experience, the endoscope, we started using it for in the last 6 months, okay? But prior to that, we were using the ultrasound, and it had a very good effect. So it doesn't have to be only endoscope, but the ultrasound is as good as the endoscope. You can see life, and you can actually do a lot.
I'm glad you raised that, Sam.
If you are able to do just a 3 centimeters of the hole.
Jay Morgan, you've seen a lot of this in practice. How do you do this?
For the deep ICHs, we leave them alone typically or put in a ventric and try to drain them, and we'll inject, like Cargill has said, if we have to try to break up clot in the ventricle. For the lobar ones, we'll typically do an open procedure after a couple days, unless they're acutely deteriorating, and then we'll go in right away and take it out. Nobody here is really using the endoscope. We've tried some of those tubular retractors. We haven't used them enough in order for us to buy the equipment, but we typically will do them open for the lobar lesions.
Terrific. Well, Estrada, we've had a survey of how this problem is treated, and we don't find a standard approach anywhere, so I think it's almost close to 10 o'clock. We've still got just about everybody here. Can I make a couple of comments about intracerebral hematoma just from
sure,
enough?
Sure, please.
And it's when I was editor of Surgical Neurology, we'd get a lot of papers, this 25 years ago, I'm just a couple of years older than Jay Morgan, and I would get a few case reports of from Japan, where they were technically oriented to do it in a very technically sophisticated manner. There were the studies that you mentioned, Estrada from England, which showed maybe you shouldn't operate on them right away; you should be delayed. Buzz Hoff from who was at San Francisco that went to Michigan, studied what was biochemically going on when you had a hematoma. And people that tend to ignore this. Immediately after blood spews into the brain, there's a huge biochemical reaction to the brain tissue of primary of secondary injury. And if you know that, it would seem that the most reasonable thing is to get it out of there as quickly as you can. Manuel Duchovny, who some of you know, did that in the laboratory, where stereotactically he placed a hematoma in the brain of some monkeys. And in one group, he evacuated them after 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or a day, and found that the sooner you did it, the more recovery there would be. I've found no standard approach to intracranial hematoma in the literature. We've had Dr. Mendelow talk about this and do randomized studies. It looks like the studies are now going to earlier surgery. All the things that are being done go from craniotomy, which Jay just mentioned, to doing in China. What they do is they put a needle in the hematoma after they see the CT and they aspirate it. I mean, there's so many people with this problem. It's probably almost the number one, besides hydrocephalus, neurosurgical problem in the world. And yet we still haven't found a standard treatment for hydrocephalus besides shunting and intracerebral hematoma. And I think, Cargill, you mentioned it a terrific way. We did that at UCLA. Dr. Martin did that, which was the same approach, going frontally, and you go back through the clot with an endoscope. You've got a defined product where it was the endoscope and the light and the suction were put together. So it looks like people all over the world are doing it differently depending upon their circumstances. And what's the right answer? And the right answer looks like it's the best that you can do in your circumstance. And I'm not sure I buy so much the randomized studies. And the reason for that, they usually take a long time. They're usually years behind, and they still haven't addressed the issue. This is over now 40 or 50 years about now becoming more acutely, which makes more biochemical sense. So that's my 2 cents worth. I think the AVM, Cargill, you did a. I was thrilled to see the what a terrific job you did technically on that. We get a lot of comments that come into the journal on videos that just aren't that elegant and simple and straightforward. And in regard to cavernous angiomas, Issam Awad is in the University of Chicago. I'm sure you know him, and is working on genetic and biological reasons why the cavernous malformations bleed and ways to treat them. So this is an evolving issue. I'm sorry if I took too much time, Estrada, but it was terrific
No, thank you.
presentation. Both Sam and your group and Cargill, just great information. I learned a lot.
Well, Jim, thank you. You have a wealth of experience in cerebral vascular disease, so appreciate your commentary. Thank you, Professor Aline, and thank you from to the group from Nigeria. This has been an excellent session. But before we leave, is Dr. Kabula still on? I know he wanted to say something about the conference that's going on in the Congo. Dr. Kabula, are you still connected? Okay, it sounds like he isn't. Well, I think, as I said, I think it's been excellent. Again, I greatly appreciate the presentations and the comments and questions. I think we had a good interaction. We'll continue next month, the first Sunday, and it will be at the usual time. With that, we'll close out. Unless Jim, you have any closing statements before we end? Oh,
No, thank
Dr. Maguho had his hand up. We'll see what he says, and then we'll close. Dr. Maguho?
Michael, do you have a call? You want to say something?
No, the hand up was about the ultrasound to know if there was a mini craniotomy or not, but it's fine. I'll sidebar the previous commenter.
Okay.
Sam had a very good, that was a very, he made a presentation about this before, and that is ultrasound, the use of ultrasound. Terrific adjunct. You don't have to rely on an awful lot of equipment. You got it around, and I think your experiences, it just adds to what people can do to treat this problem.
All
Okay.
right. Thanks, everybody, and have a good rest of the day, and we'll see you the beginning of next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
you.
Thank you.
Okay. Nice to
Bye.
see everyone.
We hope you've enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Please fill out your evaluation of this video to obtain CME credit and to help us improve our programming in the future. This recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Please send your questions, comments, or requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. And remember, there are many ways to learn. Surgical Neurology International, SNI, is edited by Nancy Epstein, is a 2D internet journal, and the second is a video journal of neurosurgery, 3D video journal of neurosurgery with interactive with discussion. The web address of SNI is sni.global. The web address of SNI Digital is snidigital.org. All these publications are free to everyone, everywhere, 24/7, 365. Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 territories since 2010. It's the third largest readership in neurosurgery. SNI Digital Innovations and Learning was begun 8 months ago. It is now seen in 141 countries. It is an all-new video neurosurgery journal. The goal of the foundation supporting these journals and this program is to help people throughout the world. In addition, some of this material may appear on Medical News Network. In an effort to bring truthful medical and science news to the world, the program is copyrighted in 2024 by the James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation, which is an IRS USA 501c3 operating charitable foundation. All rights are reserved. Thank you very much for watching the program. We hope you've enjoyed it.